Hello, and welcome to Stardust Records, a Star Wars podcast. I'm Linz, and I'm here with my co-host Savi. Today, we're going to be talking about Reign of the Empire, The Mask of Fear, the first book in a new trilogy. And to help us talk about it and to kind of shed a little bit of light on what it's like to be an editor of Star Wars books, we have a very special guest.
Hello, Tom. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi there. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about getting to chat.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. And so kind of to start us off, for our audience, could you tell us about your job as an editor as it pertains to a book like The Mask of Fear? And sort of what's your process, your editing process, I guess?
Sure. So yes, I'm an editor, actually editorial director of fiction at Random House Worlds. And as part of that very big sounding, very important job, I am the lead editor on our team for the Star Wars books that Random House Worlds publishes, including most recently, as of this conversation, The Mask of Fear. So as an editor on a book, the job and the process are pretty wide ranging and encompassing, but I think the best way to start there, sort of the broadest overview, is it's my job to work with my friends at Lucasfilm to help bring in and find authors to come tell Star Wars stories with us in book form. Whether we are telling just one story, whether we're telling a massive story in something like The High Republic, or whether we're telling a story in like a trilogy or a series like Reign of the Empire. So I'm involved every step of the way in developing the books, from their earliest incubations all the way through their development, from outlines to manuscripts to different revisions, all the way through to the final beautiful books that you can buy at your bookstores, your conventions, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, and kind of everything in between. The editor's job is somewhere between being the project manager for all of that and also being one of the creative drivers and creative supports for the author in their work as the writer.
That sounds like a lot. That sounds like you're basically the linchpin, or the guiding star, or the planet that everybody else revolves around.
I'm laughing because actually the term that I use often, which I'm realizing now is like actually a Star Wars term, but it's not. I often suggest that at a publisher, the editor is the fulcrum of the publishing process for a book, and not fulcrum in the, like, we are, you know, spies dispatched by the, you know, rebels and whatnot. Although, hey, like, I will totally be a spy for whoever wants to give me the title of fulcrum. But in that, you're the rest of the project kind of turns around you at the center, and that the other departments that are involved in helping to make a book, all the different teams who are involved in helping to make a book, inevitably you either connect with all of them or it is your job to connect them, and so you are the editor is the fulcrum.
It just visualizing it as you've explained it, beyond what, you know, being the fulcrum and this planet that everybody revolves around, it kind of makes me think of, you know, you have all these moving parts, and some of these moving parts get to see the other moving parts, but I don't think the author gets to see everything, or the artist gets to see everything, but you're the person that goes and like gets to peek inside every door and see everything all the way from the very beginning to the end, which that is such a fascinating and exciting position to be in, I would assume, to be able to see a process from beginning to end like that.
It is really cool. It's incredibly fulfilling to be able to see each part of the process and to be one of the people who gets to see the full holistic view of how a book gets made, but also then gets to be super in the weeds about every little detail. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a really wonderful appreciation for every little, honestly, miracle that is required to get any book made ever. Making books is really challenging. That's not just true of like making a Star Wars book, whether you're making a fantasy novel, crime novel, romance, nonfiction, like any book. Anyone who works in publishing on any level will tell you that making books is really challenging. And so every book that gets made feels like a miracle. And it's because it's actually the entire process is containing all these tiny little incredible moments. And it's really fulfilling to be able to get to actually witness as many of those as possible. I contribute to many of them, ideally not be in the way of most of them, but to help facilitate them. And then at the end of it, be able to like look back over the long arc of a book, its development, and be and like remember each one of those tiny moments is unbelievably. It's awesome. Yeah.
Throughout the process, when you're reading like different points of the book, is it like, do you know what's going to happen? Or is it something where like the author will show this to you and then you'll be like, oh, what? Or is it, and then you're surprised by it? Or I don't know if I'm making sense of what I'm asking, but.
No, I totally understand. The answer is yes and no. So, obviously, because the books that I work on, you know, they'll start as sort of a core idea, just a core sentiment, a core broad theme that we're like, okay, now let's figure out how we turn this into an actual book instead of just like a cool thought. And then over the course of that, over the course of wrangling that and bringing an author in and developing it, the book will go through various early concept stages, including an outline. And of course, an outline is going to tell us all the broad strokes of where a book goes and all the important things about where a book ends up, including things like, you know, who lives, who doesn't live, what big turns happen in the plot, what betrayals happen. Like all that's in there. And so even before I've ever seen the first draft of a book, I know what's going to happen in the book. But here's the part where I do get to be surprised. First of all, an outline is a roadmap, but an outline is not etched in Duracrete, right? Like to use Star Wars texture. It's not etched in Duracrete. And if along the way an author finds a different path to get to the same place or finds a better way of achieving the goals that we've all set out for the book and makes changes and deviations, well, that'll lead to unexpected things happening. But often what happens is, even though I know what's going to happen, I don't always know 100% until I read the book for the first time how it's going to happen. And that is where I get to be surprised. That is where I'm like, there, that is where and I get to go, oh my gosh, or oh, I could never have imagined that. Or that's where I get to have that very raw experience that a reader does at the end of the process when they don't know much about the book at all. So I do get to be surprised. And then I
Good.
even get to be surprised, you know, in the second revision, in the second draft, when we've had conversations about, okay, let's dial this up. Oh, there's this kind of issue. Let's try to figure out ways to solve that, or at least just raise, hey, we got to look at this section of the book and see if we can do whatever. However, the author has chosen to try to address those challenges or problems. Again, I don't always know the how. And so there are moments and there are places and there are times where I get to have that surprise experience. But that first moment of opening a book, even though knowing the outline, so that first moment I opened up the very first draft of The Mask of Fear, and even though I know where this book starts on page one, and I know about that chapter, the first chapter with Bail Organa and the Holy City, which actually originally was chapter two, I still haven't read those words. I still have not read the dialogue that Alex Freed has infused into Bail, and the grief he is feeling, and him sitting covered in dust and dirt and who knows whatever else after the stampede in chapter one, and just feeling the weight of the galaxy and the way that he is already failing his daughter, who is like weeks old. I knew that was all going to be there, but I hadn't read that yet. I hadn't felt that yet. And so that is where I get to feel all of that wonderful surprise and shock.
I feel like Alexander Freed does that with all of his
Yes.
I
And
was
yeah.
so excited to open up that book.
I was too. If in no small part because the book was had a very long, like has been in development for a long time. Not every book has the same level of development. Some books develop very quickly, some books take a longer time, and everywhere in between. And this happens to be a book that we had been working on a really long time. So it just meant that there was extra, I had extra enthusiasm about opening it for the first time because they're like, oh my gosh, the draft is finally here, right? I feel like I've been talking about this book with Alex Freed forever, and now it's here.
Okay, so this kind of leads me into what my sort of second question would be. I'll just ask that right now. So when was Reign of the Empire? So of course Mask of Fear is the first in what's going to be a trilogy. When was the Reign of the Empire trilogy first sort of conceptualized? Where did it kind of start and get its origins?
I'm probably gonna misquote myself, but it was while Andor was still airing, While Andor season one was still airing. So what, that takes us back to fall of 2022,
Two,
right? Yeah.
yeah.
So while Andor was still airing, and we were sitting down and we were just, you know, one of the things that we always are doing is we're always just tossing ideas or having thoughts back and forth around what kinds of stories we could explore, what kinds of stories might we want to explore, just anything. And a lot of times these conversations are just, they're just brainstorms or conversations that they don't all lead to like a billion books or whatever. They just back and forth, just things we're chatting about. And it started as like, could we do, we were all just so struck by how intentional Andor was in its storytelling, how tight and intentional and focused it was in creating places that felt lived in and real. Like Star Wars always feels lived in because everything in Star Wars is like, you know, all the ships are like, you know, dented and, you know, nothing works entirely properly. Every piece of clothing feels like it's been put on 1,000 times. But Andor, particularly in its places like Ferrix and in the people there, like everyone and everything about that show just again felt so intense, intentional, such senses of place and people and all these things. And I remember we were sitting down, I was just like, could we do that in a book? Which is just like an absolutely ridiculous challenge to set for yourself and a ridiculous thing to reach for because of how unbelievable Andor is. But it was one of those fun things to be like, well, why can't we try? Right. And the goal, of course, is not like, well, let's just mimic that. Cause again, that is almost rude to suggest, because then it suggests that making the thing to begin with was easy. But thinking about that and thinking like, could we do something that intentional? And within this space of talking about the rebellion and talking about the path to the growth of rebellion within the Imperial era, well, we knew, as we'd always, that Andor was never going to track and capture and show us every little detail and moment, right? The fact that Andor season one occurs, you know, well into the Imperial era, right? It's not even all that early on, that we're like, oh, is there more here for us? For is there more story to tell? Of course there is, because the journey to the rebellion is long and big and difficult. What could we contribute to? And that is where the initial kernels of what became the Reign of the Empire trilogy, that's where they started, with that sort of very ridiculous thought. And then none of us could get it out of our heads. We just couldn't stop thinking about it, which is then what means that, okay, we got to keep talking about this and really try to find the book or the story here. And that is where that turned into just from an idea to like, oh, this feels like a story that's bigger than a standalone book, right? This feels like a story that would have more, that we'd want more time and space than just one novel to tell. And so that is where we then thought of, well, instead of just a book, what if we did a series? What if we did a trilogy? And then from there, we said, well, if we're going to do that, why don't we leverage the fact that we know there's 19 years between episode three and episode four? So it's basically 2 decades. So what if we use the series to look at key moments or important times within the growth and the journey of the rebellion and the growth of and journey of the people who are going to eventually lead the rebellion or participate in the rebellion? And let's leverage those 19 years, which is something that we don't do, get to do a lot either, right? A lot of times the novels we publish are taking place over several weeks, a couple months, a year, a little bit like that. They might jump around a bit more. But all of that is kind of what led to the conceptualization of the series and the scope that we wanted to try to capture with the trilogy.
That is so fascinating to me because as you've ex like as you were explaining just there at the end, how you're capturing key moments and you're covering more ground than just a couple weeks like you do in books sometimes. It kind of mirrors the concept that they're going for the second season of Andor, which is so cool that like it doesn't, like you said, you're not trying to copy, but it's cool that there's this it's like poetry. It rhymes, it goes so well together, but they stand alone so perfectly on their own. And that's, I think, something that I was really excited for when you announced the trilogy was how, yes, clearly it's building on something that Andor's doing, but it's giving us more of a backstory. And like you were saying, it's giving us more of a look into people that possibly we don't see in Andor. And also characters that we do, and then gives us more context for them when we do watch them on screen. And I think that's so cool that you guys felt led to do that and really pushed for it, because I think it really helps, what's the word? It brings readers and media watchers closer together. And I've noticed that in, the High Republic, we have the High Republic books, and then we've got the Acolyte, which, references High Republic things. And I love that it's becoming closer and closer because, like, it's all in the same galaxy. And I think that helps people or incentivize people to read the books because it's easy to watch a show or a movie, but I think it's harder for people to sit down and read a book sometimes. And I personally, and Sabi knows too, that there's been a bunch of fans who have been led to start reading the High Republic and the other books because of that, because of the other fans being like, hey, if you like this, you'll really like this. So I just think it's so awesome that you could take inspiration in that way and kind of broaden the horizon for other people who maybe have watched Andor and go, man, I wish I had more of that. That kind of goes with it. And now they have that with the Mask of Fear and the Reign of the Empire.
Exactly. And that's something that we love to do. I love that moment when a reader, whether a new reader or someone who's already read, like comes to me and says, "Oh, I love this. Do you guys have any books like that story?" And that happens to me because I don't just work on Star Wars. I work on other kind of brands too. That happens to me at conventions or events and other things, or just online suggestions, like all the time. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I love this TV show. Do you have anything, if not just from that universe, do you have anything that feels like that? Do you have anything that reads like that?" And having a book that someone who's like, "I loved Andor, I love that kind of thing. What could I read that's going to be like that?" There are recommendations I certainly can make, actually. There's plenty of books, but having something that, again, felt as intentional as that was just something that's been super exciting to be able to tell people and to be able to share with people and build with them. And yeah, it's great. I always love that goes back to one of the goals that we always have for the books, which is like, we always want the books to complement every other story in Star Wars, not just from like a plot perspective. Obviously, if something happens in a video game or a movie or a TV show, we obviously are going to make sure that that decision or event is reflected in the books, right? But also just from the sense of like, I always want to feel like a book is enriching your Star Wars experience, right? It's like, I don't have time to watch a movie right now, maybe. Or you're just like, I'm not in the movie to watch a movie, but I want to experience Star Wars. Great, a book can do that. Or, oh my God, I finished this show. There's no more of it. And I want something that still is either directly in that vein or close to it or gives me those same feelings. Great, there's a book. It's just like, always want books to complement anything in Star Wars as much as they can. And this series, in part because of how inspired we are by Andor, and also just the fact that, like, we feel a at least I do as an editor. I'm just like, I want the book to be as good a book as Andor is a show, which again is I understand a ludicrous thing to suggest, or it's a hard thing to reach for. But I'm just like, kind of owe the folks that made Andor. It's like, that's the responsibility we owe them. If you're going to reach for them, like you need to try to reach for it, put both arms around it, which is what made trying to make this series and make this first book particularly challenging, but also like unbelievably fun and gratifying. Yeah, and to your point, like pushing it into a place that the show isn't, so that the book has even more space to tell an amazing story that can set further foundation for what we've already seen in Andor by the time you go back to watch season one, since we have backed ourselves up all the way with the Mask of Fear to literally days after Revenge of the Sith. Days. I guess it's weeks, but we could still count weeks and days. It just sounds cooler that way.
Yeah, well, and we haven't seen that perspective really yet. We've seen it for some of the Jedi who've survived Order 66. We kind of get a little bit of that, but we haven't seen, in my memory, a fallout or the ramifications for the senators who are right there in the midst of it all. And what was Saw Gerrera doing in that very first those very first weeks and months after the Republic fell. And so I guess that kind of would lead me to my third question for you. The Mask of Fear follows the perspectives of Bail Organa, Mon Mothma. Correct me if my pronunciation is wrong. Is it Sujen? Sujen?
I
How do you say
say
it?
Sujin or Sojin.
Sujen.
I
Okay.
believe the audiobook is somewhere between, but that is, I think, broadly correct.
Okay. And Haki and Chemish?
I say Chemish. I've yet to be corrected on it,
Chemish.
but yeah, so I say
Okay.
Chemish.
So we have these perspectives, these rotating perspectives of these characters, and they kind of all coalesce together near the end. Notably, Saw Gerrera doesn't get as intimate a perspective. We don't have it like from, it's not from his point of view too often or really at all. Was there a reason to view his actions through the eyes of Sujen instead of him? Was there a reason for that?
There's a couple of reasons. One of them is a bit of a practical reason. The other reasons are actually more down to storytelling choice. So one of the practical reasons, at least, that we end up with a little less Saw Gerrera time in this novel than we do, say, Balrogan and Mon Mothma as our three, as we've called them, our pillar characters, our foundation characters, is simply because the plotting and the overall story of the book. So this really is like, well, the Republic became an empire on a Monday. What happened on Tuesday? Right? Like, that's one of the essential questions of the book, essentially. Like, we've all seen the Emperor give that big speech and Padme's, this is how liberty dies. But it's like, yeah, but what happened like 3 days later? Like, what is going on? And that is something we wanted to explore, particularly in terms of the political fallout and the political change, which means we know we're going to be spending a lot of time on Coruscant and in the Senate. And Saw Gerrera simply is not allowed to be there. Saw Gerrera cannot walk into the Senate rotunda and like have lunch with Mon Mothma and like, you know, take a tour on one of the Senate pods. It's just like not a place he can be. So that means then that his character and the focus of the story, if it is a more political and Coruscant-bound story, he's just the balance of time we're going to spend with him is going to be a little uneven compared to Bail and Mon, who are on rocks. But so is that. But as far as the actual POV, that is a choice that Alex Freed ended up making in the development of the book. There was no moment where we all sat down and we said, hey, no, you can't get into Saw Gerrera's head. There's no Saw Gerrera POV. That is a choice that Alex made as he was developing the story. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think one, Saw Gerrera is at his heart a little bit, I think by design, but also just the way we see him. He's a really unknowable. He's more unknowable than Bail Organa or Mon Mothma, I think, even just at his face. And I think having that step removed helped accentuate that a little bit, but also because we knew in the form of Sojin, in the form of Karama, who also gets a little bit of POV, especially later in the book, and Bail Organa as well, we knew we were going to have a lot of characters who came into Saw's orbit and a lot of characters who interacted with him. And that led to, I think, the second reason why we chose to have the Saw scenes all be not in his POV but at it removed, which is we wanted this series always to look for opportunities to explore Saw, Mon, and Bail in ways that might surprise people who already know them or feel they already know them, or allow us to shed light on parts of their character that maybe we know is part of them, but other storytelling, just because of circumstance or the timeline of those stories, has not been able to. And so for Saw Gerrera, what we all thought about is like, you know, by the time we meet him in Rogue One, he's just like he's a broken person, right? And he is completely ostracized from the rebellion. He's basically looked at as a crazy fanatic, right? And certainly when we meet him, he does seem to really be, you know, a really broken person who's the pressure and all of the things that he has experienced physically, emotionally, spiritually, like everything over the decades of his life have really taken a permanent toll on him, right? But he's not just like a crazy person, and something that we all knew is just like people are inspired by Saw and people follow Saw. He's not just like a hermit in a cave, right? He still has this group of people who follow him. He inspires fierce loyalty, and he also inspires people to want to like act and take action against the Empire. And so, in knowing that, we were all like, well, then there certainly, and if you obviously in watching the Clone Wars, you know, much younger Saw and before, you know, he loses his sister and everything, he is this very charismatic person, right? He is a person that people are drawn to, that he is a natural leader and he is unbelievably convincing and a great orator and everything. And we wanted to try to bridge those two, not the versions of Saw, it's all one character. We wanted to try to bridge that a bit more and to give more of a sense of like, what was Saw Gerrera like and why did people follow him? And why could he recruit people even to like go live in a cave with him with barely any supplies and fight this crazy giant empire with like, the galactic equivalent of Styx, right? How did he convince people to do that? And the best way to do that is actually put yourself in the head of the people he's convincing. So you see, by being in Sojin's head, we see the way he convinces Sojin, a actual separatist, to join his cause, even if it is because they're at cross purpose and they can sort of benefit from each other, and see the way that he is able to impress himself upon someone like Kurama, who has come to his side, and even the way he makes an impression on Senator Bail Organa. And I think that is one of the large reasons why Alex Freed chose not to put us in Saw's head for the book, but to put us in the heads of the people whom Saw is impressing himself upon. But that is all to say, there is no rule and no reason why in the l later two books of this series that we couldn't be in Saw Gerrera's head and give him POV the exact same way that we did Bail or Mon. So if Rebecca Roanhorse decides to do that book two, or Fran Wilde in book three, that's awesome. It just came down to kind of the choices that Alex Freed made around this first story and the way that he wanted to present the character.
And I love the way that you explain that, because as you were explaining it to me, and I was kind of rolling back through the text in my head, and I kind of come to this conclusion by the end of reading the book that, as you were saying, we're kind of bridging the gap between the Clone Wars Saw and the Saw that we know in Rogue One or that we've seen in Rebels. And definitely the Saw that we knew from Ro or from, excuse me, Clone Wars is definitely different. He's older, more grizzled. He's been through more things by the time you get to Rogue One. And I loved, there were some moments where Sojin was noticing that Saw was learning or adapting his style or getting more comfortable in his spiel, like of how he would try to convince others of the tyranny of the Empire and how they need to fight and so to your point, I feel like it was perfect for this book to kind of see Saw through other people's eyes because we can bridge that gap really well in that way. Instead of getting inside of Saw's head, someone else is looking at him and I think then it might even be more impactful when we read the next books, if there's a Saw point of view or not, we can kind of take what we learned from the first one and kind of apply it there and see that gap being bridged. And I feel like, and this, I don't know if all of our viewers for this episode will have read The Mask of Fear, so I don't want to give like too many spoilers, but I do feel like at the end of this book, we've seen the first seedlings of Saw, that really strong Saw Gerrera that we even have seen in Andor. And it was really exciting to get that little twinge of like, ooh, I'm really excited for what's to come for him and the rest of the characters, and how they interact with each other going forward. So, yeah, I love that explanation because it really does make sense when you put it that way.
As I said at the
And
beginning, I think every choice we made about the book, we tried to be really intentional. So the fact that there's no Saw Gerrera point of view was intentional, right? It wasn't, we didn't just like roll some dice and be like, oh, sorry, Saw. Right.
oh, yeah.
Every choice we made and tried to make around the characters, what we learn about them, what we don't learn about them, where they exist, where they don't, who they cross paths with, who they don't. The fact that Bail is the first one to meet Saw, and that Mon and Ba and Saw meet under different circumstances later, was an intentional choice, and was an intentional choice in thinking about the overall relationship between the three of them and where, how they all interact with each other, and why it made sense for Bail to meet Saw before Saw meets Mon, and all of those things.
I feel, and to just add on to that point, I feel like Bail is sort of this bridge between the two of them, or this mediator in a sense, whether he realizes it or not, or the rest of them realize it or not. He's kind of this catalyst to bring two very opposite people into the same sphere, I guess you could say. Because I feel like there's lines that Bail won't cross, but there's lines that Saw and Mon Mothma would cross. And so to bring those two types of people together who have lived completely separate sorts of lives, and one's living in a cave, one lives in a penthouse kind of situation, but to be somebody that can bring those two people together, it is so important that Bail met Saw Gerrera first, because then he could advocate for that sort of person to be involved in their plan for the rebellion, or whatever action they decide to take next, because they're still kind of like, this is gonna, they figured out by the end of the book that it's gonna be a really long game that they have to play. So I think that was really a good choice, a really fulfilling choice to make, because by the end you're like, oh, this all like feels really good. This like really worked together really well. And you kind of have your little aha moments and moments where you see the beginnings of like a drop of water, like hitting, you get a ripple effect. You can kind of see, oh, this is why Mon probably is like this, or feels, or we see her in a certain way towards Saga later on. And like, it kind of sort of, it's the seedling of it. And yeah, I loved it so much. It was masterfully done.
So that actually raises a question in me, and it's not about characters, but it's more about like planets and things like that. But I noticed in Path of Vengeance and in Tempest Breaker, that came out a little bit more recently, so I guess spoilers, but Ferrix is mentioned, and we're talking about Andor and Rogue One, so it's kind of like at the top of my mind or front of my mind. But when you pick a planet, or when somebody picks a planet, is it done with the intention of like adding history to it? Like, because Ferrix in Andor we know as this essentially like this mining planet or this scrapper planet, and then now, if you've read The Tempest Breaker, you know that the Nile attacked Ferrix at one point. So is that how it's done? Like, it's done to like add that? Because now when I watch Andor on my most recent rewatch, I was like, oh my God, like this was around in the High Republic. So I don't know. Is it like where everything is intentional?
Yes. So usually if you're reading any book and you find a what would be akin to, usually like what we might call like a throwaway line, like, oh right, like, I heard about the attack on Ferrix, and like there's no like right there, that's it. You'd get no other detail, like who, what, where, like nope, it's essentially a throwaway line. It's like an Easter egg thing. It's usually made with some form of intent around wanting to build just a little bit more, I like to refer to it as like texture for a place or a character or a thing. And it's not meant to fill in completely the sandbox on the history of Ferrix, but it's just like Andor has given, and this is true of every Star Wars, it's like Andor has given us a gift. There is this planet Ferrix that we know some stuff about now. Well, great. There is now opportunity to add additional the texture to Ferrix. And that doesn't mean, of course, that you need to go color in every single little puzzle piece around Ferrix, because that's not really the point of doing that. But usually I would say when you find little throwaway lines like that, or little Easter egg type lines like that in any book, they are usually intentional. Or they're usually like, oh, I'm such a, or it's oftentimes the author or other bit, like we're so fond of a particular thing in Star Wars. It's like, oh, do we get to, can we add even just a water droplet of texture, right, to this planet or this thing, or it'd be cool to reference this thing. That'd be super fun, or like whatever. There's usually intent behind it, all the time. Usually, in fact, pretty much all the time. And a lot of times we're like, hey, we just need to reference a planet that something could have happened to at this time, and we'll just try to find like, well, here's a planet that would fit, because we need, we need something that will fit given the timeline or given the circumstance. We need to reference whatever it is. But yeah, a lot of it is just like, oh man, I love Andor. Can we reference something that might have happened on Ferrix, a couple hundred years ago? Sure, why not? That's usually where stuff like that comes from. And it's fun. And gosh, Alexander Freed filled the Mask of Fear with references like that to people, places, things, planets, moons, organizations, companies, like everything. It suffuses every page of this book, the depth of detail that he put into it. Into all of those little things. And I know all of those were intentional in some way. Even if some of them I had to go look and be like, what is this? Oh, right, it's that thing. Because they were really, really far afield, really cool, like deep, deep, deep cut things, that were
Yeah,
fun.
I had a certain color. I did like the little notes on my book, and I had a certain little color sticky note that I would put for something to look up later. Because I was like, oh, I know that I should recognize this. I should recognize what this name or this reference. And so I'd put a little note and be like, look this up later, because I'm pretty sure this is supposed to be something that you know about, perhaps. And so I had a lot of fun with that too. There's something for everybody in these books. If you have read many others and or you've consumed a lot of media that it's referencing, there's something for people like that who pick up on those things, and there's stuff for everybody else. And I love it when that happens. And there was something that you recently posted about that I hadn't realized. There was a one of the last interactions in Mask of Fear is between Mon Mothma and Masamata, and they have a mirroring interaction, I guess you could say, in which book is it again?
It's Life Debt. It's Aftermath Life Debt, a book that was written in
Okay.
2000, that came out in 2016. So basically came out 10 years ago, 9 years ago.
Yeah. And Masamata says something to Mon Mothma in Mask of Fear, kind of in a sort of needly, kind of like sarcastic, like, you know, a nasty way. And she gets to say the same thing back to him in that book that was written 9 years
Yes.
ago, 9, 10 years ago, but is in the future. So, you know,
Yes.
post Return of the Jedi, I believe, right?
Yep,
Yes.
it's you know, in that first year, it's in the few months actually after the Battle of Endor.
Yeah, and I thought that was so cool. I was like, you guys are such big brains
So that's
to make that
where
connection.
I'll tell you where that came from, because I love this, and this is indicative of like why making books in a big storytelling world like Star Wars is so much fun. Is that was a masterfully collaborative effort between a bunch of people. Because so Alex Freed writes the draft, and the chapter that you were talking about, which is a chapter called The Century Plan, which I promise you, dear reader, if you have not read it yet, when you do, you will never, ever, 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 ever forget that chapter. I wrote a very long message to Alex Freed after I read that chapter for the first time. And it's not a spoiler to say that at the end of this book, the rebels don't win because the rebels don't exist yet. But that, let's say, hope is not at its highest near the end of this book, and this chapter is partially reflective. And when I got to the end of this chapter, first time I read it, to your question earlier about do I get surprised, I wrote this note to Alex Freed, and I wrote in the margins of the manuscript, I said, I know what happens in Star Wars. I know what happens to these characters. I know what happens, and I know that the rebellion wins. But after reading this chapter, I actually don't know how it's possible for them to win, which was actually the goal of that chapter and partial of the goal of this book, not to remove all hope from the story, but to make it as clear as possible how impossibly high the mountain is to climb. That the fact that they survive even long enough to even think of stealing Death Star plans, much less attacking the Death Star, much less eventually one day defeating the Emperor, is like an impossible miracle of miracles. And this is the chapter that's really meant to codify like that mountain is too high. Like, how are you going to do it, even though you already know? So anyway, he writes that. And that chapter is amazing and brilliant. And in fact, in terms of revisions and edits and changes, we touched very few words. But in looking at that together, we all were reminded kind of collectively, or like, wait a minute, these two have an interaction in the Aftermath trilogy, like many years later in universe and 9 years hence. And there's a scene where Mon Mothma and Leia talk to Mass Maeda. And because Mass Maeda and Mon Mothma, at least, it's like that would, you know, if you're like, oh, when did Luke Skywalker talk to Yoda? You'd have a billion examples of it, right? But I think because these two characters, at least in terms of the storytelling we've seen, don't have a million interactions, I think that just stood out more in people's minds. So we're like, is there something? We dug into Aftermath, we reread that scene a bunch of times, and I was rereading the scene one night, and I found that line from Mon Mothma to him. And I was like, oh. And I remember I sent that paragraph to Alex Freed, and I said, can we do something with this? And he was like, that's great. And he put it in. And then the next draft came in, we showed it, and it was like the perfect combination of a great piece of writing already, the recognition of, oh, there's a potential connectivity here. And then not just creating connectivity for connectivity's sake, but actually finding that dear, wonderful Chuck Wendig actually 9 years ago left us a beautiful gift that he probably doesn't realize he left us, which is this perfect line of dialogue. that we could backtrack into this book and fit ever so perfectly in this book to then connect those two stories, which are separated by nearly a decade in real time. And it was brilliant. It was actually one of the last changes we made to the book before the book really got totally finalized, was this little adjustment of, I don't know, two sentences. It's actually maybe not even, might have only been a sentence. But yeah, I love that. Love that connection.
It must be because we started this interview saying that it's a gratifying process, the position that you're in. It's gratifying to see something to beginning to end. And it also must be on a even it kind of like zooms you out even further when you have moments like that where you can be like, whoa, we can take something that we did so long ago and make this beautiful connection, this really like kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, like let's give a, you know. I smiled so much when you posted about that. I was like, oh, that is so cool. I was getting like chills. Like, that's so cool because it adds so much more to that scene in that book that was written in terms of like, ooh, kind of if we have that context, those words that she spoke to him are even more of a like, ooh, you know, kind of sticking it to him. Even if he maybe didn't even remember the words, if you kind of like think about it in the universe. Terms, but saying that to Mon Mothma in Mask of Fear, I just love that. That's so cool that you get to do this and see that, and it adds so much more. And like you're saying, it connects things. It's connective tissue, and I love that the Star Wars books that we've gotten since, I guess, would it have begun probably with A New Dawn? All those books since then. When there's moments where they can connect to each other or reference each other, even in the slightest of ways, I feel like that just adds so much more to the work as a collection.
It does. It also keeps other books. It's one of those wonderful ways of keeping other stories alive, right? And there's always value in going back to a story, right? There's value in reading books that were written 200 years ago, 300 years ago. There's value in books that were written yesterday, value in books were written any other time in between. But it's a beautiful, wonderful way to keep those stories and keep the contributions that the storytellers made to those books to keep them really alive and keep them kind of give them. Like this texture to make them more kinetic than if they were just, oh yeah, we told that story. But it's also, and this particular example is beautifully illustrative of one of the goals when you're doing that we always try for is like, I want that moment to hit hard, whether you know the Aftermath trilogy exists, whether you don't, whether you've read it, whether you remember that, whether you make that connection or not, right? I want that line, I want that moment to still resonate regardless of how much info you have about it. And that's always one of the other goals too in creating this connectivity. Obviously, sometimes you're telling stories that are literally sequels to things, right? Or that are handing off plots to things. And so, yeah, you kind of needed to have read that. But when we're telling a story that is either a standalone or a story that is meant to be a place of, yeah, as do you know what Star Wars is? Great. You can start here, right? That's the only barrier to entry. Are you aware of what Star Wars is? That those moments resonate for those readers, even if they don't get that added bonus little Easter egg moment that someone else
Yeah.
does, right? And I think that that moment works perfectly. And I think that that moment balances that perfectly.
Yeah. And that's kind of the experience that I had because when I first read that line, I didn't make that connection at all. Didn't have that connection in my brain. And I still felt that it was impactful. And then learning about it, I was like, ah, and it kind of had a second moment of like, it was a kind of a twofold like, you know, seeing it for the first time, not understanding, and then understanding, and it was just so neat. And so, and I guess that's something that can that be hard to balance sometimes in terms of, you know, having a book where the only barrier or qualification is, you know, what Star Wars is, sort of having something that's written that can connect, anyone can connect to and get into, but also provide more context or deeper, I guess you could say lore, I don't know, for readers who are very familiar. Is there sort of a formula that you guys kind of go with, or is it just sort of as it's being edited, as it's being reviewed, you go, maybe too much here, maybe we need more context or something like that?
Yeah, it's There's not a formula. There's not a form. I think one thing that we do try to keep in mind at the genesis of a project is we do try to think about, okay, in terms of the audience. Audience is always like, hey, people who like Star Wars, but you know, that's a very broad group, and you know, you've got to be more specific. So it's like oftentimes it'll be, oh, all right, so our audience here is people who might be really into this particular part of Star Wars. So for Mask of Fear, it's like our audience is Star Wars fans. We also definitely are making a book that we want to appeal to people who enjoyed Andor, who watched Andor, who are keen on storytelling similar to Andor. We also recognize, though, that because this is a book that is set right after Revenge of the Sith, that this could be a kind of onboarding book, a book. This could be your first Star Wars book because, you know, have you seen Revenge of the Sith, or are you at least aware of it? Whatever this, there's not a whole lot of extra need in order to gain admission to this book and have, let's say, the most fulfilling experience. Of course, anybody can pick up any book and just read it and have probably a good experience, but it's like, are you having the optimal one? Are you having the most intended one? Are you having a good one or a great one? There's always balance. So at the start of a book, we kind of think about how much of a book for, I don't like using the phrase real fans. I just hate that. So I always use the phrase more engaged or less engaged, because I also don't like using the phrase casual. So I use more engaged and less engaged. Because to me, a more engaged fan of anything is just someone who spends extra time beyond the story time. It's like they read wikis, they like devour nonfiction lore books, they're like, you know, on forums trading theories about things. Like, that doesn't make them a better fan, obviously, than someone's just like, well, I just go to the movies when the movie comes out, right? It just means your level of engagement. So anyway, we talk about that. And it once in having those conversations, it allows us to then approach the book of just like, how in the weeds should we get? And some books will get more in the weeds, and some books will get less. And then within those, we'll also then be mindful of when is one of our Easter egg references, or when is one of our pieces of connectivity, like, is it overwhelming the story? Is it going to confuse somebody? Is it just going to be like, oh, okay, that is certainly a Star Wars name, right? As you might suggest if you read something where you didn't know exactly what it was. Or is it just like, okay, that's clearly a reference to something. I don't know totally what it is, but it's not confusing me, right? The scene that I'm in, the moment that I'm in, it's not breaking my experience of reading. And we just dial that in. And sometimes that really gets down to choosing the exact right words in a sentence. Sometimes it's just like, how many of these references are too many? It's a broad balance between like large scale thinking about how to implement these into books and very nitty-gritty, very specific implementations of individual ones. And you sort of pick your spots. We don't want to have them on every page, every sentence, because that suddenly you're not telling a story anymore. You're kind of just bulleting cool lore, which is great, but that's not really what a novel's for. And so yeah, it there's no formula for it, certainly. It's an art, not a science, but the more you do it, the kind of better you kind of start to get at understanding, you know, what the balance is. And most importantly, it's just like, is knowing what this thing is intrinsic to knowing what's going on in the book right now? And if the answer is
Yes.
yes, then we balance, okay, how much do we imagine the readers for this story are going to know what this is? And if we think most of them are, we'll probably do very light scaffolding on explaining it. If we think most of them might not, then we actually might explain it more and almost assume the most of the readers aren't going to know what it is, or aren't going to have the best recall of what it is, and at least need a reminder. Even if, hey, you read Aftermath, you know, 9 years ago. Now this is not a case of that, but you know what I mean. Like, it's not just about people who either know or don't know. It's just that, you know, chances are you've probably forgotten a lot about Star Wars just because there is a lot and there's a lot to consume. So yeah, it's challenging. It's something to think about all the time. I, with rare exceptions, I never, I personally always approach books as like, I want my book to be able to be read by everyone, from the most engaged Star Wars person down to the person who is just like, hey, I want to read my first Star Wars book. And every Star Wars book is probably not the perfect one to be your first Star Wars book. But I would like to think that most books can at least provide a reasonably good core first Star Wars experience, while also being as satisfying for the person who, like, the moment a book gets announced, they pre-order every book and they buy three copies of it because they also got to get the con edition and this thing, and they bring them to the conventions and, like, they, you know, annotate every single page on it. It's like, I want the books to work as well for that person and the person who's like, I like Star Wars, what should I read? It's unbelievably hard. Don't know that we always perfectly succeed, but that's absolutely always part of the intent.
And I feel like you guys succeed in that. I feel like there's something for everyone in Star Wars, no matter who you are, what you like. If you like reading, if you like playing video games, if you like just watching a show or a movie, like there's something for everyone. There's various flavors and everything. But I think specifically for the publishing side of it, there's something for everyone in terms of books. Like there's so many different perspectives, and the writers all have this really, they all have really distinct styles that are so satisfying to read. And so I think you guys have done a really one, from my perspective, you guys have done a very wonderful job at kind of building out the universe and adding more threads to the tapestry of Star Wars. And in I love allegories. But yeah, I love it. And so kind of just continuing on talking about this series, when editing The Mask of Fear, did you have any communication with the other authors in regards to planning how the plot will continue from Mask of Fear? Or is it one of those situations where, you know, The Mask of Fear had its story that it was telling, and then the next couple books will have their stories it's going to tell, and maybe there's reference back to what occurred in the last book, but maybe there isn't. Maybe we're just picking up with them again at a different point in their life. Sort of, did you talk to Alexander and the other authors at the same time, going, hey, this is something we want to make sure that we continue? How did that look like? Have you talked to the other authors as Mask of Fear was being written?
We have the answer is both. And I'll explain what I mean. So first of all, by the way, I had a conversation with Fran Wild, who's writing the third book in this series, not very
Oh.
long ago. And we were talking about some
Oh.
stuff related to what might go on in the third book. And I've been having lots of conversations with Rebecca Roanhorse, who is obviously working on book two. And so I'll explain what I mean by this. So this is certainly a case where, when we announced the trilogy and announced the series, we announced all three books, all three authors, all three releases at the same time, because we brought everybody to, we figured out who was going to write each book and got everybody signed up and got everyone signed on to the project at the same time, because we wanted there to be some cohesive and collaborative development between the authors in building the series, because they're not each writing a standalone book, they're writing a book within a trilogy. However, it's interesting, and it actually goes back to what we were talking about the shape of the series and the arc of the series, and the fact that we have a trilogy that is going to exist across the long arc of those 19 years of the development of the rebellion. And so the reason why the answer is both is we've always said, though we haven't said yet exactly how much time, but we've always said that between each book, there will be a time jump. And a considerable time frame, not like 5 minutes, not like, oh, here's what happened, this book ends on Monday, here's what happened on Friday, like a considerable time jump. And because of that, that means that each author does get to tell, and we do want each book to be story complete. What I mean by that, or plot complete, is that at the end of each book, the plot and the story and the core concern, the core conflicts, obstacles, etc., of that story should be done. Should more or less almost read like a standalone. And in reading Mask of Fear, I think you'd agree that obviously Star Wars does not end at the Mask of Fear. But like if you only read the Mask of Fear, it's like, yes, the sort of core conflict of this story has been resolved. And of course, there is a tomorrow, but that book does not end on a plot cliffhanger. Right? It does not end on like, well, wait a minute, Bail has been trying to do X and we don't know if he's succeeded yet or not, right? And so that means that if the next book were, say, going to pick up a week later, a month later, even a year later, right? The kind of handoff of the plot baton would be more important. And the handoff of the story baton would be much more, each book would be much more dependent on each other, because there's just very little time for anything else to happen in Star Wars, right? In the way that when The Force Awakens ends and Rey is standing there with Luke, and then The Last Jedi begins, and Rey is standing there with Luke holding the lightsaber, and he picks it out. It's like there's no room to be like, well, this happened to Rey between those two stories, because there's no time between them, right? So the way that this has worked is, we worked with the three of them at the beginning, and in bringing them onto their series, sort of said, okay, this is what we largely envision for the series across the overall arc. Here's the goal. And also to say, okay, which of these books are you going to end up writing? I always knew and always really wanted to, and he was happy to do it. Always wanted Alexander Freed to write book. But then in talking to Rebecca Roanhorse and Fran Rodden, and figure out, okay, who's going to write book two and book three, and what are the benefits of writing the middle book in a series versus the finale? And, either author having preferences. And I'll say everyone's very happy with which book they're writing, which is great. But what we end up doing is then, okay, Alex Freed is going to build out what he's doing in his story. He's going to build out, we've got our foundational characters, Mon, Saw, and Bail, which again, beginning of this series, the idea of it contained them. He's going to build out his original characters, his sort of core concern, what he's going to be doing. And then once we had that solidified, and once we had his outline solidified and really knew where that story was going to go, sort of then went to Rebecca and said, okay, here's kind of where everything's ending, and you're picking up the baton X amount of time later. Well, the beautiful thing is, because there is more time between his story and yours, the characters don't actually all have to be where Alex left them on the last page of his story. Rey does not have to be standing in front of Luke Skywalker, and so what that gives Rebecca the freedom to do is Rebecca can now look at her story and figure out and design the kind of story that is most important to her and speaks to her as an author, as an individual, as a person who's got perspective on telling a kind of story about this, and build that, picking up the baton from Alex. So bringing some of these characters that we met in book one, not just our foundational characters, but some of those other characters who will travel into the series and grow through the series. But they don't all have to be where we last saw them, because if more time has passed, well, things can happen to people, right? When there's a larger gap. And so that allows, and then of course, where Rebecca's story will end, the same thing is going to happen for Fran, where she will pick up the story sometime after Rebecca's story and build on from there, but also have the opportunity to place characters and place story in the places that speak most to her. She's not just executing Alex Freed, the third part of Alex Freed's story, right? Or the second part of Rebecca Roanhorse and vice versa, but they are also working cohesively. And they are saying, okay, here's what Alex has built around this character. Great. How can I yes and that, right? How can I build off of that and continue to explore this character or continue to grow them, knowing the history that Alex Freed has given them. And there were a couple of things, I won't share what they are now, but maybe, I don't know, a year from now or something, we'll chat about it. There were a couple of things that actually Rebecca, in designing for book two, that as we were continuing to work on book one and the drafts and stuff, we actually went into draft one and like made a few little tweaks, made a few little adjustments, set a few more things up, did a few other things in order to put certain things or certain characters. Not to like, oh, you were driving them down the wrong highway, we got to turn around, but just to like actually give them even better foundation, because we knew what Rebecca was going to do with them in book two. And I have every expectation that as we're working on book two, that we'll be doing the same thing around, like, well, we kind of know now where Franz wants to land them in book three. So, oh, hey, why don't we dial this up? This will create more interesting symmetry. This will, help explain something now that then in book three, we don't have to explain it. Actually, we can just pay it off or whatever. So we're doing things like that. And all of the authors are wonderfully collaborative and wonderfully unprecious about not just obviously characters like Mon, Saw, and Bail, who they're Star Wars characters, right? But even the characters that they're developing and even the characters they're originating who are going to be handed off to other authors have been very unprecious and wonderfully collaborative around like, great, I had my fun with these toys. Now they're yours, whatever you want to do with them, whatever you're going to do with them. And that's been really exciting. But the last reason why we wanted to do it this way goes back to the idea of intent, which is, let's think about the Empire and let's think about the state of the galaxy over the 19 years between episode three and episode four. Well, the galaxy is a very different place in year one than it is in year 10, than it is in year 12, than it is in year 15, 19. And so you wouldn't actually want to tell the same story. If you're one of your, if the story is in year one and then it's say in year nine, I'm making this up by the way. Don't anyone go update the Wikipedia page on what it's like. You know what I mean? It's like the circumstances of the galaxy are very different in The Mask of Sphere and even in Andor season one, right? And obviously even in the year of Rogue One and A New Hope, the literal circumstances of the galaxy, which means you shouldn't tell the same story because a different story is better positioned with different themes, different conflicts, different problems, different characters and character perspectives in different areas. And you are actually not doing the best service to that era. And you're not doing the best service to like the places where you're telling your stories if those stories are not going to have the ability to be developed and to fit and take full advantage of what's going on in those time periods. Which is the other reason that we wanted each story to be plot or story complete and hand the baton off to the next and build a series, but give each book its own identity. So I can tell you for sure that when you read Rebecca Roanhorse's book two, it's not going to read exactly like The Mask of Fear. That is by design and that is intentional because the state of the galaxy is not as it was in The Mask of Fear, right? The things people are worried about are not the same as the things they're worried about in The Mask of Fear. And so that's one of the reasons we built it this way. And it's tremendously exciting. It's even more challenging, but that's fine. That's part of the gig.
That was the perfect answer in terms of my question. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. This just makes me even more excited to read the second book and the third book. And to your point about how the galaxy looks different in when you jump, time jump. And so you're saying that you want to be very intentional about that and the rebellion's growing. We're picking up with the rebels in a different, it's forming. And so of course it's going to look different. And that's what I was so excited about when the series was first announced was I love the rebellion era. I love to always know more about the struggle to throw off the chains of oppression. I love that. And I think that you guys are definitely delivering that. And I knew you would when you guys announced this series. And so, yeah, definitely so excited to see it continue. And that sort of just leads me into one of my last questions would be, or yes, questions. So the book follows the efforts of a handful of beings, all determined in their own ways to make change, either personally or on a galaxy-wide scale. So, but I think by the end, what many of them have come to realize is that it's a long game. We kind of mentioned it earlier, how this is sort of a long game. So, what is the long game of this trilogy, or kind of, I mean, no spoilers, obviously, but is there a specific end point that you guys want to be able to wrap up on? And like I said, we're not looking for spoilers, but sort of an end point feeling that the readers are we you want to leave the readers with?
The endpoint of this series broadly has always been we know the Rebel Alliance gets made. And not only that, we all know the Rebel Alliance wins. We know that the Empire does not last forever. We know that hope endures the long night. And we know that eventually the heroes win, right? And what we want, the long game of this trilogy is about making people by the end of it understand that Luke Skywalker might be the person who destroys the Death Star. And Leia might be the beacon and core leader of the Rebel Alliance who helps facilitate that. And heroes who get put in position to save them, as we see in the original trilogy. And I think what we really wanted to further underscore and help people understand, which again, I think one of the goals of one of the things that Andor does, and Andor season one does, and I have every expectation Andor season two will continue to do so, is to help us understand that like the journey to get to that moment involved so many different people and so many things and so many people who never become heroes, and that building a rebellion is difficult and challenging and dirty, and people at the beginning don't all make it to the end. Even the people with the greatest and best ideals, or the ideals that fundamentally underpin the foundation of the movement, they don't always get to actually participate in the movement. They don't always get to survive to see the movement victorious. And in fact, movements clash as they grow, and people who started it get pushed out, and they are messy, complicated, difficult things, but that those conflicts and that difficulty and that journey, that conflict, that rigor is like what makes it all the more impressive when they succeed at the end. That that's actually where hope comes from. That this is a trilogy ultimately about not why is hope important, we all know that, and not what can hope can achieve or accomplish, because Rogue One shows us that, A New Hope shows us that, all those things. But where does hope actually come from, and how hope is something that people actually create, and they have to like you have to like keep hope alive and fan the flames of it. And like, how does that happen? And how do we do that within the con how do we show that within the context of the journey and the growth and the eventual birth of the Rebel Alliance? And so by the end of the series, I hope that everyone will have, we hope that readers will have a greater understanding and appreciation of that journey, and of that journey as told, not just from the point of view of the greatest legendary mythic heroes of Star Wars, but also the normal people. And also some of the mythic heroes, but before they became mythic, when they were just people, when they were just senators, or they were outcasts and they were making flawed, challenging, difficult, impossible decisions. But it is, you know, ultimately, because Star Wars is about hope, like the goal of this series is to end on hope and to end, you know, on the idea that all of this is ultimately worth it, even if everybody doesn't make it to the end, right? I mean, heck, we know Bail Organa and Saw do not make it to the end of this journey, right? And to try to capture that, and to try to really capture that as best we can, again, across a really long arc of time, and to make you appreciate how precarious it was at the beginning, how the like rebellion almost ends before it's even a whisper of a thought in anyone's mind. And then how, you know, how do so many different groups of people and people with different ideologies, even about broadly the same thing, how do they even try to begin to come together? What happens? The more people come together, the more the Empire notices, the more the Empire is like, we're not doing that. And then suddenly, then what happens when you are actually a Rebel Alliance and you are no longer just a couple of people in a room talking about the future, that the future is now. That's the long game, which is about hope. It's about generations. We get to play with generations in this series. We have to think about like generational rebellion, which is so fascinating. It's like Bail Organa and Leia are part of the same rebellion, but they are of different generations, right? Jin and Saw Gerrera. Even in this book, it's like obviously, you know, there are characters here who are very young and characters are very old, but all a lot of characters come together. You know, just look at the people in Rogue One around the room when they're just talking about what to do with Jyn Erso, and you have Cassian, you have Mon Mothma, you have Bail, you have Merrick, you have Dodonna, you got all these people, these multiple generations of people who definitely all don't have the same views on rebellion. And oh, by the way, all of them weren't rebelling at the same time, which means what happens when the older generation needs to make space for a younger generation, and the younger generation suddenly says, well, we believe in rebelling, but we don't want to rebel the same way, or you guys are doing it the wrong way, right? It's the long game of this trilogy is exploring the Rebel Alliance from every potential angle possible, and the journey of that from every angle possible, in a way that hopefully we haven't seen done before, in Star Wars. And every time now that I just said that, wow, this proposition in this project sounds even more scary, even more challenging than it's already been. But it's a wonderful challenge. It's a wonderful challenge.
I think you guys are off to a great start, and it's definitely, I feel like it's going to be so gratifying for everyone involved and super satisfying for the readers. It already is, and I think it's in the best of hands. Yeah,
Well,
we
thank
are
you.
I'm serious. I keep saying I'm so excited. I love it so much, but I think it's for most of the people, everyone I've seen that's read the book, it's kind of a general consensus that this is solid and we're excited for more. And it makes me very anticipatory and hopeful for other projects in the future after you guys, because I feel like, is this, would you say this might be a project that's unique and something that you guys hadn't really done before? Or is it kind of a new thing with this? Do you think this project will help inform you going forward to any other projects in the future?
Hopefully, because one of my goals whenever I'm moving from one book to another is like learn something from the previous book, whether about process, about editing, about storytelling, about anything, and apply it to the next. It's like use this project to make the next project better, even incrementally. So ideally it does book to book, and ideally it does with the series. Certainly in terms of the overall organization of the series, the idea of using multiple authors within one story and whatever, totally taking a little bit of inspiration from stuff that we did with the High Republic. It's a little bit different, obviously. We're not, it's not quite as numerous in terms of the number of books and the scale of things and the sort of crossing between formats, but that idea of having multiple authors contribute to like a large overall story, and then have individual authors, of course, taking on specific elements of those stories or specific parts of those stories. That's something that we sort of took some ideas from High Republic and be like, oh, it worked for that, it worked in this thing. And so ideally, yeah, it's every time we do a project, and ideally every time we do a project well, we always try to think about, okay, what worked about this? And what can we bring forward? And what didn't work about this? Let's not do that again. Or let's do it again, but better the next time. Yeah, for sure.
Well, and that kind of leads me to ask you what I keep saying this is close to my final question, but this will be sort of my last, this will be my last serious question for
You
you.
sound like many of my author calls. We're like, I just have one more question about the next one. I'm like,
This
sure, as many as you want. This, my job is to be here and answer your questions.
will be my sort of my last sort of serious question, and it kind of leads into what we were just talking about. Is there a book or a book series in your career that really stands out to you in your memory? Something that you would look back on really fondly, and one that you've learned from in regards to your work. So, how you were just saying how your collaboration with the High Republic authors and how you went about that helped inform perhaps the way you went about this series. But is there any defining book or book series that you just love to look back on? More of a personal sort of like,
Is it
I'm sure you
really?
love them all in their own ways.
No, I do. And I was going to say, this is like asking me to pick a favorite child. And I don't generally do this. And the reason being, I'll actually explain the real reason why it's really hard for me, is that when someone asks me about favorite book or favorite series that I've worked on or favorite experience, the first thing that I think is not the book itself. It's not the story. It's not the plot. It's not the theme. It's not the characters. It's not the era. It's not anything. The first thing that I think of. So I think about the author or authors. I think about the person that I think about the people that I worked with as part of the larger team on my team, if it's with Lucasfilm, it's with one of my other licensing partners. Like I think about the people, and I think about like the very first thing I think about is like, oh yeah, that first time I sat down with this author to ask them if they want to do this project. Or the moment where we sat down after the outline and I was like, man, the outline's approved and it's banger. Or when the book was done and I was like, hey, by the way, you're going to be a published star. You're done. Like, and I think about those things before I think about anything related really to the books themselves, which means that it's very hard for me to choose basically a favorite person. And I have had the this distinct pleasure of working with really only wonderful people across all the years that I've been editing books, which I know in publishing is not always true. And I've really developed absolutely wonderful, cherishable relationships with a lot of the creative people that I've worked with, which makes it hard to separate them and pick a favorite or pick even one that stands out. Though, in service of that, I will give you a few, with the understanding that in terms of the people, I love them all equally.
Yes.
So one is remarkably personally satisfying, personally gratifying, and fulfilling that I have been able to work on any books, and I've worked on what, six books with Timothy Zahn, if only because I've been reading Tim Zahn since I was a wee child, and Tim Zahn has been writing books since literally before I was born, and Tim has always been, ever since the very first project we worked on together, unbelievably gracious in treating me as a creative equal and a partner in the storytelling, even though I am many decades younger than Tim. And even though, again, Tim was winning writing awards and has forgotten more about writing than I will ever know, and forgot more about writing than I will ever know before I was even. And so it is unbelievably grateful. And also just like it's weird to be like, I grew up reading this person and they were one of my favorite authors, and now I'm their editor, right? Like that. So those moments and those experiences particularly near and dear to me. The experience of making those from a certain point of view anthologies was particularly satisfying, if only because it seemed like such a terribly bad idea that we should not even try to do, given the complexity of it. But the fact that we did it not just once, not just twice, but three times, made that particularly satisfying, but was oh so fun. And oh so ridiculous, but again, fun and just an unbelievably satisfying thing that let me work with tons of different authors and people I have dreamed of working with my whole life and people I grew up idolizing. And even if I only got to work with them on a short story or something, that is particularly fulfilling. This series so far has been, because again, we're reaching for something really big and difficult. And all of us at each stage are just like, this is going to be hard. But what I have always loved about working on not just these books and any other books is just like, I love that you don't say no to something just because it's hard. If you want to say no, if you want to not do something, that's fine, but you need to have a different reason other than it's hard. And that's a sentiment that the team that I work with and have worked for a while, like that's a sentiment that they instilled in me, and all of the folks that I work with have that sentiment too. And so I do love the fact that we're just reaching for something challenging and hard. That has been particularly satisfying. So all of those projects. The last thing, if I'm picking something, and again, love all the creators and writers equally, but the last thing that I'm particularly proud of and I found particularly gratifying, if only two, because it's a little bit of a different thing, different project, and I like getting to try different things, is the project that we have. Oh man, we must have only just announced it like a day or two ago. It's probably very recent if folks haven't seen that. Coming this October, we are going to be publishing a special deluxe edition of the novelization of Revenge of the Sith, because obviously this year is the 20th anniversary of the film and that novel. In fact, the actual 20th anniversary of the novel is like 4 days ago. It was April 2nd. And so we are making this deluxe edition, which, if folks have not seen it, please go seek out the. There would have been an article on Collider about it a couple of days ago. And if you go to any of the social media for the Random House Worlds and the Star Wars team, you'll see it. This beautiful deluxe edition that has all sorts of amazing bells and whistles in terms of the packaging, sprayed edges. We got end papers. We got the little, these little satin ribbon bands, ribbon markers. We got a cool see-through jacket thing, and pretty, it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful books we've ever worked on. It's like taking what we do for convention editions and dialing up to 11. But even better, it's not a convention exclusive. You'll be able to buy it wherever you want. But the thing about that book that is so extra special is that I got to spend a lot of time working with Matthew Stover to fully annotate that book and fully annotate almost not every page, but near every page of that story, and work with him to help share his experience in creating what is a Star Wars and honestly just a book masterpiece, and to tell stories and share insights into the creative process, to tell stories about his experience writing it, to talk about like, how the heck do you write a line like this is how it feels to be Anakin Skywalker forever? Where does that come from, Matthew? I literally asked him that question at one point. And to have him tell you that as a reader, and to have that be encapsulated into a book that you'll be able to buy and experience, whether you've experienced that book a million times or it'd be your first time. Getting to do that with Matt, getting to do that with Matt Stover, unbelievably, unbelievably exciting. It's one of those things that I will check off as like one of the coolest things I've ever done. And I can't wait for people to see the kinds of stories and the kinds of insights and the kinds of things that he was able to share about that experience of writing that book. So that one is probably, along with the working with Tim and the FacPov books, those three stand out. Those three experiences stand out among many, 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 many others. But if you're asking me today, I'll pick those. If someone asks me
Oh.
tomorrow, if someone asks me tomorrow, I'm going to pick different books because, again, I cannot pick favorite children. But
Okay, our viewers, our listeners can't see our faces right now, but I've been grinning this whole time just hearing all this. I'm so excited for this. This is going to be yeah, I'm that person, that gif of that guy that's like tapping his credit card like really vigorously, like please, I need it. I'm so excited to read it and see Matthew's thoughts, and because I know it's such a prolific book in the community. Most a lot of Star Wars readers hold it in very high regard, and it is one of those sort of just monumental pieces of writing in terms of the Star Wars galaxy or Star Wars universe. So, yeah, wow. Thank you. That's awesome. And I think sort of segueing out of that, because you were just saying how, tomorrow you might have different choices. We're gonna also offer you another choice here. Our last question, the fun question we do with every single guest we have on, is if you could shadow one Star Wars character for a day, just sort of be their like buddies or either Padawan, they're your mentor, or you're just on an adventure with them. Somehow you got wrapped up on and taken away through the stars with them. Which Star Wars character today would you go with? Who would you shadow?
Oh no, I'm gonna end up regretting this as soon as I give an answer. I'm gonna have
No,
one of those things where
no,
no. Let's see, who would I shadow? All right, well, I'm probably not shadowing any Imperial, just because that's not gonna be a fun day, all other things aside.
no.
Man, do I want to shadow a droid? Do I just want to like hang out with R2-D2 all day or something? Or BB-8 or not
This is just your
C-3PO.
choice for today.
Yeah. I think, all right, I'm just this is I want to hang out with Brasso, because Brasso, that's I
Yes.
just want to hang out with Brasso. Probably gonna work hard, that's fine. We might also like punch a stormtrooper with a brick, but whatever it is, like that guy is awesome. Maybe I should have picked the dude who bangs the clock tower on Ferrix, but no, I'm gonna pick Brasso, because Brasso is just awesome. He's great, you know. He's seems like a down. What is the? There is no equivalent for down to earth in Star Wars, because Earth doesn't exist. You can't say Earth. He is a down to insert Earth equivalent here. Person seems cool. He's gonna stand up for what's right. So, you know, at the end of the day, I'll probably be really tired and sore and may have lots of injuries from either very hard labor or getting in a fight with stormtroopers. But I'm gonna know we did good that day, right? So I'll pick this up.
I love it. I love it. I think, after a hard day's work, you guys go to the cantina, share a pint or little, pub food and talk about the day, and I feel like that would be, I feel like you could have a real good time with Brasso. He seems like someone who would give good advice too. Even if he's not even realizing he's giving the good advice, I feel like he would just be a good conversationalist as well. You bring up something and he's like, oh well, da, da, da. I love that. And usually we end with so we ask you this question and then we kind of throw out who we think we would shadow for a day as well. And so the cool thing is that Savi and I get to have so many different answers for all these different interviews, and we usually don't try to pick the same one twice. So mine for today, because of recent announcements, will be Ventress. I would love to hang out with Ventress. Would Ventress love to hang out with me? I don't know. Maybe not. I'm not going to put myself on a pedestal. But if I ended up in a situation where I was with Ventress for a day, or she was stuck with me, I wouldn't mind. I think I would like to have that experience.
That's a good one.
Savi, what about you?
I have a feeling I've probably already said him before, but I would really. Okay, no, never mind. I won't say him, because I definitely think I've said him before. I'd love to. I don't know if exactly shadow, maybe like stand beside, but I'd love to hang out with Briaga. I've been thinking
Oh.
about him more recently because of trials coming up soon. And yeah, I think he would be really fun to hang out with. And he's an empath.
Yes.
And I think that he would have a lot to say, even if I wouldn't understand it at first. But so, Buryaga for me.
I love that. I love that. Good answers all around, you guys. Very good.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be learning a lot.
So Tom, thank you so much for coming on. We really enjoyed this conversation. I feel like
Thank you.
there was a lot
You're
of
welcome.
insight into things that I had wondered about, and hopefully we can have you on again sometime. There's, the High Republic initiative is ending this year-ish, I guess. So there'll be things to look back on and speak of, retrospectively. And I'm sure, if it's not that, something else. But it's been so wonderful to have you.
Thank you. I would be happy to come back anytime you want. The nice thing about telling Star Wars stories and Star Wars books is there's always something new to chat about. More than happy.
So, where can our listeners find you if they want to know more of your antics and keep up with you?
So if you want to get in touch with me or you just want to keep up with what I'm doing, you can either follow the Star Wars books Twitter and Instagram accounts, which is the Star Wars by RHW accounts. But if you also just want to connect with me, I'm Darth Internus, Internous on Twitter and Blue Sky.
And Lindsay, where can we find you?
You can find me at A Cosmic Love on Twitter and at Rebel Risen on Instagram. And where can we find you?
At Andorisms on TikTok and Twitter, and you can find the pod at Stardust Records without the O on Twitter and Instagram. And that's all for this episode. Thanks again, Tom, for joining us for it. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.